You're listening to Signal to Noise on the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. This episode is brought to you by the following sponsors: Allen & Heath and their new CQ series, a trio of compact digital mixers for musicians and bands, audio engineers, home producers, small venues, and AV installers, placing ease of use and speed of setup at the heart of the user experience. RCF, who just unveiled their new TT Plus audio brand, including the high-performance GTX series line arrays, and the GTS-29 subwoofer. Be sure to check it out at rcf-usa.com. That's rcf-usa.com. I wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be. I wish I could break free. Hey everybody, welcome to this week's edition of Signal to Noise. This is actually part two of a conversation that we started in episode 243, so if you haven't listened to that one first, I suggest going back and checking that out. In that episode, we talk with Aaron Paligian, Brian Maddox, and Michael Curtis all about the input side of corporate events, lav mics, lectern mics, and a bunch of processing tricks and placement tricks to get them to work better for you. This week, we're going to focus on the output side and talk about some strategies for managing live streams and records while also managing in-room sound at the same time, since often on small to medium corporate events, one person ends up having to manage both simultaneously. Before we do that, though, the quick usual bit of housekeeping. First of all, if you love the show, we'd love for you to go into whatever podcast reader you're using, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, anything else, and give us a good 5-star rating and tell people what you think of the show so you help other people find it, too. If you've got feedback on the show, you can also email that to us at signal2noise@prosoundweb.com. That's signal2noise@prosoundweb.com. We're also still always looking for more questions from listeners that we can answer on the show, or tips and tricks that you might want to share with listeners. So if you've got any of those, you can either email those to us as text and we'll read it for you, or make an audio recording and email it to us, or you can go to speakpipe.com/S2N. And again, these are all linked in the show notes, and leave us a voicemail there. Again, questions, tips, you're also welcome to leave us feedback there as voicemail. And if we like what you send us, we'll probably use it in a future show. And otherwise, we just love to hear from you either way. That being said, let me get back into the discussion with the guys. I'm going to roll it back and give you just a little bit of a rewind to see where we left off last week, and then we'll hit the ground running. Enjoy. I wish I could break.
And the dance, the D-A-N-S-E emulation in the Ravage, and I believe it's in the new DM7, is a really, really good emulator for the Cedar. And Cedar done right is an amazing... That's one that you can put on almost everything. And as long as you go easy on it, it will just make everything cleaner and be completely transparent.
Yeah, and two things I'll say on the dance, which is an amazing emulation and one of many, many reasons I love a Ravage anytime I can get it, is A, if you're in the latest updates to the version 6 software, they've gotten rid of the extremely disconcerting bug where after you hit the learn button on dance, audio would not alter at all for a good 10 seconds or so, and it would definitely make you clench a bit. So if you have avoided using a dance or because of that, they have acknowledged and fixed that in one of the recent updates. And the other thing, which I think Brian was kind of getting to in passing, is that while the default settings work great, if you know what frequency range you are trying to get rid of, you can narrow those handles in, and it becomes that much more powerful because the bands can be narrower, and it also takes out the worry of hacking at something you don't want by mistake. And I mean, I've had shows where I've put it on 4099s on like wind and string instruments that were a little too far and picking up too much room. And yeah, if you tune it just to that part where you're getting the hiss or the buzz, like it's also one of the best ways to remove bass amp buzz I've ever had.
Yep. I'm nodding vigorously because I've had to do that exact thing. Yeah, and you just kind of, like, particularly if you dial it in tight to the range that you want to make sure you're not, like, losing the fundamental. I mean, you don't even really have to, but it gets that much better when you do. Yeah, that's been a big one. I'm curious if anybody's tried, I think, because Waves make their spin on that now, too. Has anybody used that? Yeah, I think we've got homework. Or have you, Michael?
I have a handful of times, and it's worked well. I get handful meaning two, so a couple of times.
All right.
Is that the clarity? Is that what they call that?
Actually, just the W84 WNS.
Oh, okay, I gotcha.
So it's like an older processor, but it's similar six-band guy. And it was on a Waves LV1 I was doing for a political gig, and it was actually outdoor, and it was more for wind noise and road noise rather than like a room. And it worked well. So
yeah, that was going to be one of my next questions, was because I know that's one of those things, if I'm doing a record or stream, that's one of the first things I'm going to drop in. But I've also taken to doing it when I'm just doing in-room sound too, and I'm curious folks' feelings on that side of the question.
It actually does more of what you would hope a 5045 does than that. So, you know, helping get rid of the extra room that leaks in, and it's a lot easier to ride the tightness control, at least in the Yamaha implementation of it. And I have also found adjusting that range so that you're not necessarily getting rid of all the super high-endy stuff, because if you let it, it will totally make it so that, when someone stops talking, it is almost dead silent. And I know Brian has some thoughts on, it maybe shouldn't actually be dead silent when someone's not talking in the room, but or for a stream, let's say. But the in-room sound and, what happens for the PA, it really does help clean up that too.
Well, and I don't know how much time we have left, so I don't know if we can completely pivot into this, but yes, one of the things that you want to watch out for is when you're doing a recording, or especially when you're doing a stream, like we've talked about all of the different ways that we can clean up lectern mics and clean up lav mics so that it's like all we're hearing is what they're saying and we're hearing nothing else. But then in a stream, that ends up sounding really weird because now we don't hear any of the room. We have no sense that this person is speaking to a live audience. It sounds like they're in a studio, and that's where you start to dial in your ambient mics. The great thing is that if you can control all of the ambience that you're getting from the talent mics, then you can add exactly how much ambience you want to give that still a natural sound of people are in a room. You now have control over it as opposed to just a bunch of stuff leaking into the lectern mic. And it also just means that all of that extra ambient sound, one of the things that took me 25 years to realize was the ambient sound in the room that was coming back into my lectern mic was being reamplified back into the room, creating more of itself and coming back into the lectern mic. I mean, it's not true feedback, but the amount of ambience that's being produced out of the PA adds to that ambient sound in the room, which you already have plenty of because the room is already reflecting. But yeah, the more we clean these things up, the more we really have to look at making sure that we have some kind of ambient something to kind of fill in the holes for streaming and to some degree for records.
So, yeah, I mean, that's a question implied right there that maybe we get into a little bit is live streaming versus records. Are there differences in the goals between the two for you, and what are they, or how much is that dependent on the gig?
And are you asking me or the group?
I mean, asking the group, but why don't you go first since you're the one who kind of inspired the question just now.
Since I inspired the question. So I do. I have two different approaches, and it really comes down to a lot of mistakes in records can be fixed in post. So I tend to be very conservative for records. I don't worry quite as much about smashing, you know, dynamic range. If I have the option, I like to record the ambient mic separately so that in post they can add as much or as little as they want. But, you know, and I tend to be conservative with regards to the level that I'm hitting records at, because again, you know, in post they have the option to fix a lot of this stuff. Now for a live stream, now I'm delivering a live broadcast show. And so I need to significantly narrow the dynamic range. I need to work at getting the microphones and the spoken word stuff to be much, much closer in level to the playback stuff, which can be a significant difference if we just simply were to take the PA feed and stick it on a stream, like easily 10-15 dB difference. So we need a different ratio between those two. And we just have to really concentrate on narrowing the dynamic range in the stream and also making sure that there's some ambience in there to again, give the people that are watching a stream a sense of this is an actual live event. I'm not watching a studio. So to me, they're kind of two different things. And, I'll sometimes get in situations where the video department will be like, oh, just give us a feed and, you know, we'll split it and we'll put half to the stream and half to record. And I'm like, oh, I really, really don't want to do that because they're two very different things.
Yeah. And I mean, and I'll throw the footnote there that I is kind of implicit in what Brian said, that that's also a thing you need to ask the client, both for a stream and a record, is what is their goal? Sometimes, like, particularly, say it's a training session, they may want it like, no, we want it to sound like a produced, like, training. Like, the gig I just flew back on, the directive was basically, we don't really care what it sounds like in the room as long as everybody can understand it. We want a, like, clean record that people are going to go back and listen to later, or people who couldn't make it here, you know, and, like, the content is king on that one. And like the fact that it's in a live room almost doesn't matter. It's just to give the presenter somebody to talk to and for people who wanted to come see it in person.
Yep.
And then as far as achieving that dynamic range goal, because that's been the big thing, particularly as we go to live streaming and particularly as we all start doing streaming mixes from the same console often enough, is those dynamic targets for streaming where we're getting into like, you know, neg 14, neg 16, you know, LUFS, LKFS is, it's hard to hit. That's a really, really narrow dynamic range. And I'm curious, and I feel like at some point, whether in person or Discord, I've talked to all four of you about tips and tricks to achieve that, both live and in post. I mean, it's a thing that like I deal with every week for the podcast too, of trying to hit those, you know, similar targets. And that's certainly easier because you can do it in post. I'm curious for folks both if you've got ways to do that in console, particularly on Yamahas, which seem to be the de facto corporate console most days, and gets a little tricky there. I know I've found I'm blanking on the model there, but there's the Neve like bus processor that's in the CLQLs that the limiter and the comp on that are actually in the wrong order from where I would normally default to if I was using two separate pieces of gear to accomplish that, but it works well enough that usually in one piece there I can get it. I've also sometimes done like chaining, you know, like the 1176 and the 2A, but like more aggressively than you would, but similar to a rock vocal where using one to narrow a little bit and then one to squish the crap out of, and then the channel limiter to keep it from clipping out, which when you're trying to get those high, you know, like loudness targets becomes a real concern. And then, yeah, there's like, once you start being able to add outboard plugins in, a wider world opens up a little bit, which I can weigh back in on, but I feel like the other folks here might have smarter answers than me on that one. So, what you got?
Overall, I agree with the method of using multiple layers of compression in different places. That's the only way you have a shot. If you try and hit it with just one big bus comp at the end, it's going to sound bad. And what does bad sound like? Meaning that you
my mixes.
Meaning that the voice doesn't feel like a dynamic voice anymore. It's just kind of this brick wall of sound. And there's some vowels and some consonants in there. Kind of gently compressing at different stages helps. And so things like dynamic EQ, watching your low end on the channel side, also keeps your compressor from working too hard and pumping too much later on in the chain when you put it there. But yeah, I will definitely do something akin to that kind of bus processor, and then also using the LA-2A emulation as a true limiter. It's not a peak aware limiter, but it just gives you that extra like bounce when someone says something really loudly or they clap or something like that, something silly like that happens. And then on the output itself, the very brick wall-y kind of compressor, basically set to limit at -1 or 2 dB just to actually catch peaks and keep it from clipping and overdrive, more importantly, from overdriving another device in the chain. Because eventually you're sending this audio somewhere, and that may not be able to accept what you're putting out. And
Samesies. I think I even stole one of these tricks from you, but I used the 2 dynamics inserts on the CL or QL. One kind of like you would 76 and 2A, but one is kind of a super duper fast attack, like 1 millisecond attack, 4-to-1 ratio, and 100 millisecond release. Just catching the kind of peaks, like the first one I take, Aram, I think you're the one that told me about this, but like getting just those like peaks when they get loud. The other one is more like 1.5-to-1, still a reasonably fast attack, but it's lower threshold and kind of getting the rest of it. So it's a little more steady state, but neither one of them is really smashing that vocal too bad, but just kind of like keeping it in check. And those are after the dynamic EQ that, like you said, is keeping that like super low mid out of there and getting that crazy. I think that's a trick I stole from either Ryan or you, but either way, I'm just stealing all these tricks and compiling them together. Then on the bus, another basically channel compressor from Yamaha to keep the bus intact so that like when one person is speaking, there's not a lot of compression, but if there are more people speaking, then it kind of kicks in and keeps everybody about the same level to the audience-ish. And then on the stereo bus, the 33609 with the limiter in, kind of getting a little bit, because I'm an old rock and roll guy and I can't freaking help myself, but to have a little bit of squeeze on my stereo bus. And that, like you said, the limiter at like -2 or 5 or whatever its top most highest threshold is, but it just has a little peak to keep the tops on. And I find if I ride things up and down into that, I can get the levels that we need without clipping things in the chain next to it. And it all still sounds pretty, I'm going to say reasonably dynamic, even though it's all, squished a little bit at a bunch of different stages. But that's worked pretty well for me without having like an L3 or something to like really smash it at the end to get it to be like show volume, you know what I mean? But to really just actually hit it with level rather than a limiter has worked pretty well for me.
I'd say the only real tweaks from what y'all guys are saying is I use on the detector circuit on the program compressor, I'll high pass at like 150 just so like the DJ isn't making it pump if I need to hit that loud, just so that I can take some low end out of that circuit. I've also been formulating a YouTube video in the back of my brain just for a super, super clickbaity title, but it's called Why You Should Mix on the Game Knob. But it's basically like, we have to keep the signal chain coming through all this stuff so sensitive within a very fine range and all of it being pre-fader that sometimes you really have to level out presenters with the gain first, and you're not riding faders near as much as you would think, except for in-between presenters. So it's just splitting out in your brain, what is the gain knob for to keep your signal chain happy? And then faders are only for per presenter relative balances. So I think that what makes you really hyper-aware of in corporate work is the exact gain structure of everything flowing through every place. And then once it actually hits a channel, then it can be fanned out to a prompter feed, an overflow room, a lobby mix, like keeping track of all these places is a lot. But to come back to your actual question about processing, is another guy commented that there's actually a limiter in the dynamic, the multiband compressor on the CL. It's called ceiling. But I couldn't find it in the DM or the Ravage. But is that a thing, Aram?
I don't know. I actually went looking for it too after seeing that, and I didn't see exactly what that person was referring to. But I didn't get to spend as much time playing with it as I would have liked to. I know there are two multiband compressors though. There's the premium rack one, and then there's also like an old multiband compressor.
The one that's just in effects, the not one in that's premium just rack? In
effects. Oh, yeah. It might be there.
It might be in that one.
I just went to the premium rack and looked, and I was like, I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, I was like, I see it in the manual, but this guy's smoking crack, and I couldn't find it. But okay, I'll have to find the not the unpremium, the Honda right. Civic.
Unpremium, you diva.
Yeah.
The old EDM 2000 expansion pack.
Yes.
Right. You know, the one thing I have learned today, Andy, through all these guys, is that you have been replaced as my most expensive friend, and Brian and Aram have just cost me fucking DM7s, you guys. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I mean, Brian said it to me probably not even a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, that basically we're now spoiled brats, and going back to a QL or CL is like, really, do we have to?
Yes, dude, totally. Yes, it's dead to me. I did have two quick things to add to this, only because no one else has said this. One, you know, when you're talking about getting stream levels and making it, you know, basically getting a ton of compression, but making it as transparent as possible, there's two things that I like to look out for. One, making sure that I'm using a dynamic EQ with the low frequencies, basically to eliminate p-popping and proximity, because, you know, when we get presenters and they eat the mic, as soon as they p-pop, everything you have compression-wise after that suddenly triggers, because it's just gotten hammered by
totally.
And that makes your whole level dip for a split second, and it's just really, really obvious. So, you know, that's a kind of a main, like, if you start with that, that helps you a lot farther down the chain. And then this is another thing that I'm really coming around to. I have never been a external plugins, external processing guy, mostly for reliability reasons and because I'm old. But
I'm in the same shoes.
But I'm coming around to the use of some of the more advanced external plugins, specifically post-console into a stream. And I'll tell you the reason why, because we have access to plugins that might have, 10, 15, 20 milliseconds worth of latency, because they're primarily used for DAWs. But when we're talking about doing streams, we have a luxury of, we have to add delay. We have to add delay to resync back to video, because we're always, you know, 80 to 100 milliseconds ahead of them. So now we have this window that we can use to use look ahead compression. And as soon as you get into look ahead compression that's got 10, 15, 20, 30 milliseconds of look ahead, you can really start putting in, you know, finalizer plugins and you know, really, really high, the kind of stuff, again, that you would normally use in a DAW, and get these really just really way, polished, way sounding, more leveler. Like, you can use a leveler, yeah, and yet it be much more transparent, because, you know, it's able to adapt to the peaks that are coming in ahead of when it gets there. You know what I'm trying to say? It's the, you know, the difference of what you can do with plugins in a DAW, because it's all look ahead, versus what you can do in a console, which is all, you know, 1 or 2 milliseconds worth of time are night and day. And so this is the one place where you can really leverage that extra latency to get results that you really can't get in the console, if that makes any sense.
That's actually one of the two reasons that I bucked up and bought an RUIO. The being able to do that mastering style output has been great. I'll use the Ozone Maximizer, which actually has a low latency setting on it that is pretty quick, but it's still just that transparent, quasi true peak aware kind of processing, which is fantastic for that final bit.
And it sounds awesome.
Yeah, it sounds really good, and being able to help your stream out in that way makes it, you know, worth it for me. There's all kinds of other elements that go into that, and I did mean to jump back and correct something. You know, we're talking about the latency for these plugins. There is, anytime you're doing something outside of the desk that isn't just analog, you also have to, especially if you're hosting plugins somewhere, you need to measure and figure out how long the actual round trip latency of these devices is. Because even if I have a quote zero millisecond latency chain in Live Professor, for example, with my RUIO, depending on what I set my buffer settings to, usually for it to be in a safe position for me, it's a round trip of like 13 milliseconds. And that means you can't do certain things, or you need to compensate for certain things somewhere. But just something to clarify for anyone that, you know, is considering going down this road. There's a bunch of different things to think about. But some of the tools can be really effective out there.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. It's zero added latency to the insert path as exists. Yeah, we're always talking a base level above that.
Totally.
And appreciate clarifying that. And also the highest latency thing I've tried lately for that thing was something Michael turned me on to recently, which is SoundRadix Power, which I did try on my record mix actually for this gig this weekend, and it's pretty solid. It's like you have to get into like a little bit of like understanding like how gain structure works in it, and like it's very much one of those plugins where I wish it had a true peak limiter in it, so I don't have to put one after. But then you have to get into the mindset of understanding and knowing that the tool you have it hosted in is working in Floatland, so that like that clip light at the end of that, as long as you're dealing with
ignore
it after the fact,
it's so
is
hard,
fine.
But ignore it.
Yeah. Which I mean, the quick and dirty for folks who don't understand is the true peak basically means like I don't understand the math well enough to explain it, but it is possible to get inter-sample clips like between the samples where, if you look at a straight meter, no individual sample is clipping, but like as the signal pieces back together, is my understanding of it. It basically it can clip between those samples, and most audio processing software nowadays works in 32-bit float, where there's so much dynamic range headroom that that's not actually an issue as long as you deal with it before you convert down to your 16 or 24-bit output. So I think I ended up using Waves WLM Plus, which was, A, it gave me a second stage of Luffs metering that a couple parts of it are a little easier to read the short-term and momentary from across the booth at the console. And also the one tool it has in the Plus version, other than metering, is that it does have a true peak limiter. So you can set that to whether -1, -0.1, 0.2, somewhere in there, depending on your needs and range of comfortableness.
Totally.
That worked pretty well. There's still, I gotta spend a little more time experimenting with it and like understanding a couple of the quirks of how things work and where with like setting trim on that particular processor, like the input clip works, and again, the as long as you listen to it and it's fine, you're probably fine, but it depending on how much you're pre-processing the dynamics of what's going into it, it can still get a little butt clenching on the input meter and can get a little crunchy if you don't manage what's going into it well, I think. But that was the easiest time I've ever had hitting like a YouTube-esque like -14, -16 streaming target.
Nice.
But I gotta try the Ozone Maximizer and compare it now.
Well, and this also brings up a good point to illustrate is that, as I mentioned before, you're sending these things to all kinds of other devices. It's really easy to forget that you probably need to calibrate and actually send tone and actually make sure that, you know, what is neg 12 or neg 14 that you see coming out of your console is the same number that's hitting, you know, the recorder you're feeding or the stream encoder that you're hitting. And that can be really challenging at times. And you know, you need to jump in, and when you need to make sure that when, especially for streaming, that when test streams are happening, you have everything ready to be able to send them tone, and then also be able to monitor it back and know that what's coming out of that stream is what you're putting into it. Because when that doesn't happen, bad things happen. And I actually had a gig recently where we were feeding an encoder, and long story short, what happened with the digital encoding that we were doing wasn't working. And so we ended up needing to bail and use the, you know, analog into the eighth inch jack on the encoder, which, and this was all happening about 2 minutes before the show started. And so immediately, you know, the show begins and it is just a nightmare of audio. And of course, because there's about a 30-second delay, I'm just slowly riding down the level and then hoping that within 30 seconds I'll be able to get to a point where I know that, you know, it's not going to clip anymore and it's not going to distort. But yeah, you got to check all that stuff and make sure that what's coming out is what you want it to be, and what's going into all those devices is too.
1,000,000%.
I got a couple, hopefully, pro tips here. If you're testing Zoom or Teams and you do a tone, even if you have original sound on, the tone won't come through.
Also, voice denoise. The tone will duck by whatever your range is, yes. And it'll send you panicking for like, yes, 20 minutes trying to find out where you're losing gain till you realize.
So I like doing like a drum loop that's like kick snare hat and has peaks that's truly hitting the limiter, and so I know. And then number two, I stole this from you, Lean. You can view the test stream on an iPhone, then use that as an input device on a Mac, and then actually record in the digitally passed audio into a DAW and then meter it there and actually see the end user loudness and look at peaks in the actual stream there.
I got one of the USB-C AVIOs. And so whatever I want, yes, and because, yep, I know, because it's USB-C and because it's full scale Dante,
yep,
coming in, when I bring that back into the console, I know that that number hasn't changed somewhere. As long as the computer volume's all the way up, YouTube, mm-hmm, volume's all the way up, whatever, that what's coming out is exactly what it should be.
See, now I'm going to need a second AVIO for that, because the other place I was going to suggest that is I have taken to using the Ulean iPad app on either a phone or an iPad mini with the USB-C, mm-hmm, AVIO as a meter. So it's because it packs a little flatter than the TC Electronic meter does.
And just to jump in, my trick to do the exact same thing is a laptop running whatever the destination of the stream is, be it if it's an in-house stream or it's a YouTube stream, and I loop back into the Ulean meter, and so I have that sucker just running all the time. And that's giving me, this is end user digital to digital. This is exactly what the end result of what it is that I'm pushing in. And, you know, if you're going to multiple places, maybe you're going to YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and whatever, you can also switch between windows and see the difference in what the processing in between what you send out is actually doing coming back the other way. And you can do it all within one device. I have like a 10-year-old MacBook Air that I just already have set up for this. So I just bring up a web window and, you know, basically I'm just monitoring with Ulean meters right there exactly what it is that's coming out of the stream.
Can you go into that a little deeper? What are the Ulean meters, you guys?
So Ulean is a software app, and there's both a plugin version and a standalone for desktop and an iOS app. There's a basic version that's free, and then a pro version, and the iOS version, Ulean Lite. And it's loudness metering, so it's doing that LUFS, LKFS metering, short-term, momentary, long-term. So similar, if you know, like the TC Electronic loudness meters, it's a very similar to those, just in software form.
Got it. I got it. I've been using the Waves, like you said, WLMS Plus. That was the thing I was going to add, is that that's the one plugin I do use. Typically, I'm in Brian's camp where I'm all in the desk, but that's the one plugin I do use to make sure that we're getting the right levels to the records. But I'm going to check out that Ulean thing, because that being able to monitor that back after the stream is dope, rather than just like listening to the stream going, it sounds good, and the meter says on the way in, it's fine. And, you know, that's a way, like third, fourth, triple check is great. Mm-hmm. And I will like 1 million percent second, third, fourth, and fifth Aram's comment about like, check what you're hitting downstream. Yep. You know what I mean? Send it tone or level or something. You will be surprised how many times people that are in other departments besides audio, without throwing anybody under the bus too badly,
are not
aware of gain structure in audio. And so the amount of times I've had to go sit in front of somebody's ATAM and say, hey guys, maybe turn those inputs down. You know what you can do on this stereo thing I'm sending you? You could pan them left and right. That would be super sweet if it came actually panned, and go and look at that. And like you said, just, I'm doing it simple. I'm just sending tone at, you know, minus 18 or whatever RMS, and getting it happen. You know what I mean? So that what's coming out of my desk is what's showing up at the records. And like 9 out of 10 times, it solves almost any problems we were having, you know, if you weren't already. But that hopefully gets done before show.
So yeah. You know, a lot of those devices have metering that is not the same as your metering.
1,000%.
And, you know,
but it's red. But it's red.
I have had, you know, webcast people, we'll call them, that, you know, I'm sending them a good, strong, healthy, and controlled signal that has been calibrated. And then, but because it went red, not that they heard distortion, not that it is distorting, but because they saw red, it got turned down. And then the end result of the stream is a lot quieter than it should be. And this is a thing that could have been prevented by the conversation of, hey, these are the steps I'm taking. These are the things I'm doing. We have now calibrated this. If there is an audio problem, let me know before you change something.
No touchy.
Can I hear what it's doing and putting your own ears on it?
Yeah.
And the two things that popped to mind just from like the last week or two for me are like, I've seen a certain infamous and broadly spread hotel in-house provider, we'll say. I think y'all know who I'm talking about. I've seen times where like they don't have like a split six or even Y cables. Yeah, Y is, they've got like a little switchcraft splitter that is mic level, and they can pad it down to take line level, but you have to A, make sure that's happening, and B, still be aware of what that's doing, because then they're going to be gaining it back up on the other side, and that can wreak all sorts of havoc with the end product. The other thing on verifying chain, this is a thing that I was talking about, inquiring about, venting about on the Discord the other day, is I just picked up one of the little Zoom like 32-bit float recorders, because I like the idea of a recorder that I've got a backup and I don't have to pay too much attention to what the gain is. As long as I know what I'm feeding, it isn't clipping, it's fine and I can deal with it later. But while it is spec'd at a maximum input level of plus 24 dBU, and while the Yamaha console output is spec'd as a maximum output of plus 24 dBU, if you hit it with that, it will light up the warning constantly on the peaks, maximum input exceeded. I'm a little unclear on whether it's, again, is that a safety below where it's actually hitting maximum input, or are they just that slightly different in rounding errors that the Yamaha's version of plus 24 is slightly hotter than the Zoom's? And that's a thing that surprised me, particularly on a recorder that's the, in theory, you don't really have to worry about it, having to actually worry about it. And I feel like I had another thing I was gonna throw in on that, but Now I don't remember what it is. So
I think I'm probably the only person in the world that absolutely loves that in-house provider you just spoke of.
Well, yeah, because they get you lots of work on the repeat case.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. They call us all the time, and I freaking love them. Love them, because they do basically all the convention centers and big ballrooms and all stuff. You know, they got all that stuff here, and so they're always like, hey, did we have a band? We don't know what to do. Hey, we've got more than five channels of comm. Hey, we've got this. And I'm like, yes, we'll come right down there. Yep, absolutely. We'll take your money. Yes, sir. We would love to come do that.
Well, and, hey, and we've got the you've whole... You've also got one that admits that they don't or can't. That's a... Oh, totally. Not all That's of a, them do that.
Oh, totally. Which dude. Is some we of had problem. One where like they called and they were like, so we got the new convention center and we have the whole ballroom upstairs. And we don't own enough PA to do this. Can you come do it for us? And we were like, sure, totally. So we, you know, made our design or whatever. And it was like 48 boxes of our HDLs or whatever floating this whole thing. And they were like, that's a lot of PA. I was like, it's a lot of room, bro. But they, yeah, they call us all the time. We love those guys, but it's exactly what you just described, which is why they call us all the time. Because yeah. It's like, they're like, well, can we provide our A2? Absolutely not. No, you cannot. No, we're tired of teaching your A2 how to comm or how to RF and then them not RFing or comming. And we have to do it anyway. So no, we'll bring our own A2. You know?
Yeah. I mean, we're getting us back onto the track of like...
Sorry, dog.
No, all good. All good. But back onto the track of streaming and recording stuff. So obviously, Ideal World, somebody dedicated for that, whether mixing or at least like monitoring it. Reality World, particularly as we're streaming things that are glorified breakout rooms sometimes... We've been talking a little bit about strategies on the mix side of how to do that while also mixing, you know, for the room. What about then monitoring it? What are you folks doing to? Yeah, Aram just gave the look of what I was thinking. but yeah, I'm curious what folks are doing to, because I mean, I like particularly this last gig, which was in like a small, like one of those like the half ballroom kind of situations. And going back and forth between like sometimes trusting the meters, sometimes cans, and sometimes near fields, which is where I kind of damn it, Andy'd myself on my day off in Vegas and went to the Vegas Guitar Center and got myself some adorable little near fields just so I had an option because it turned out that infamous AV provider didn't have something suitable that I could use. And I was like, you know what, F it, I'll just buy something so I have it, which are these adorable IK Multimedia iLoud micro monitors. Which they're like on sale right now for like $300 for a pair. The amps in one, they're like deeper but like skinnier than like the little baby Genelecs. And like I'm not gonna ever like claim it sounds like a baby Genelec, but like particularly if I'm monitoring a stream that's being listened to on like earbuds or a laptop speaker, this is like perfectly at it. And like they punch a lot more than you'd expect from looking at them or from what they cost. So,
bro, for $300 a pair, they right? are smoking.
Yeah, so that's like, my new toy. And had we done the coolest thing in arm's reach, that's what I was going to bring out.
At no time am I trading in the Focals or ATCs for them, but they yeah. are smoking for $300 a pair.
Yeah, like for something you can throw in your backpack or like a Pelican or Nanook to bring to monitor a stream, they're pretty tight. But even with that, like having near fields there, it's like when you're trying to do both, are you like spot checking the streaming? So are you keeping an ear on it the whole time? Obviously, there's a latency concern to keeping that. So I'm curious to kind of go around and hear what everybody else does.
I'll say if the console is able to do it, I default route my stream feed to the Cubus out. As like if I'm not queuing anything, that's what's going there. Or I'll just always have the Cubus queued or the stream feed queued if it's not there already. I'll do my best if I have time to be super nerdy and actually calibrate my headphones, like run it through either an EQ that's similar to the offset curve in a Sonoworks or something like that, just so my headphones sound better. Having a little squawk box or Fostex or whatever just to cue things up is always helpful. This is unrelated to that, but just so I can have to babysit and listen to less things at once. I'm not sure what, I would be curious to hear you guys' workflow. When working with an A2s, you know, so we have eight presenters in this next thing, the A2 gets one mic'd up, they're going to go on comm like, hey, presenter number one's mic'd up, can you PFL it? Make sure it's good. I've actually started using the second Cubus and having that to an analog out on their stage box into an in-ear pack, either wired or wireless. And then I basically, with an iPad app, they can PFL their own channels. And so that's like something else that's kind of like off your plate, because you have to listen to the stream, listen to the room, do all this stuff.
Get an all theater up in here.
Yeah. And so basically that might be old news to you, theater guy, Andy, but that was a new workflow for me.
Admittedly, I don't always get it on like corporate gigs either, but as both an A2 and an A1, that's how we do it in theater. Like, we'll do a mic check before the show with everything with the PA. But during the show, that's the A2's back there at a listening station. That's often WaveTool is commonly used for that on the software side. There's hardware solutions for it, or even a dedicated console. But the iPad app and the second Cubus is a damn solid and expensive way to do that. I like it.
Like, get scrappy
technically
around
I
here.
Believe I, it's so rare that I've seen people actually set it up, but I know for at least the Axiom Digital stuff, you can set it up so that one headphone output, it can actually cue any of the other things in the rack by routing some Dante around.
It's a little tricky, but I have definitely done that when I've been A2ing, and it is absolutely helpful to be able to just single button push. It's a little easy if you have a spare receiver and you use that spare as the one that you monitor anything on. It makes your life a little less complicated, because switching between monitoring local and monitoring the Dante selection gets a little janky. So if you can use a spare receiver for that, I recommend it. That's a solid reminder for folks that's there. And I can vouch that it does work well once you take the time to do it.
One more thing as far as, I guess, listening with my eyes is I always have a machine up with iZotope's Total Balance Control 2 on the modern curve. And dialogue, I feels like if it's within that span, if folks don't know what that is, it's basically a target curve with basically a 12 dB plus 6 or minus 6 dB. And it doesn't care about absolute level. It's only concerned with relative level between its bands. And if that curve is floating in between there, I can usually trust that there's not this huge 500 honk that I haven't taken out of the lav or something like that.
So I'm a little bit old school when it comes to trying to monitor a stream and a live show at the same time, in that I really don't feel like I can do both things at a level that I feel like I would be proud of. So sometimes it comes down to what Andy said, which is, what's the priority? Is it the people in the room, or is it the people on the stream? And I always ask the question, and 90% of the time I get both as the answer, which is not an answer. But there you go. I try to get a good balance between the microphones, the playback stuff, the ambient mics during rehearsals when I have the ability, when I can throw some headphones on and listen to that stream. And then I tend to kind of largely ignore the stream. Now, I have a TC clarity meter that's always on that stream, so that I'm looking at relative volume, relative levels, and making sure that my levels between my microphones and my playback and all that stuff are staying consistent. One of the tricks that you can use is, if your ambient mics are in stereo, the little triangle in the TC clarity meter that shows the width of the stereo field will show you if there's just a single microphone, it's going to be a straight line. But as soon as your ambient mics become more prominent, like people are clapping, that triangle is going to widen. And so it gives you a visual reference of the difference between the two. So I'll rely on that a little bit. If I have a trusted A2, that's a big if. But if I have a trusted A2, then that's when I go to using the monitor A, monitor B bus. I give the monitor B bus to the A2, and I let my A2 be my QC for QC the microphones when you put them on presenters, and then QC my stream mix, because they can obviously cue the stream mix to their in-ears or to their headphones or whatever. And if there's a little tweak needed between, oh, the ambient mics, the clapping's a little bit too loud, or there's a little bit too much room, then they can also kind of assist me in doing just, you know, very basic little tweaks in that. But I find it just at least for the shows that I do, because so many of the shows that I do are not well rehearsed. It's off the fly. There's so much I'm trying to keep track of to make sure I don't miss a cue, don't make sure I don't miss a thing. And I'd hate to be concentrating on, do I have too much 500 hertz in the stream and miss a mic cue? You know, it's like that's kind of where my brain is on it. But it's challenging. It's very challenging to be able to try to monitor a stream and monitor a live show at the same time when you're really doing two completely different things.
And I'll say there are ways to kind of help your streaming self out. Like, for instance, I'll set up a separate bus that serves as a ducking input for my NAT mics for video rolls.
It's funny, Michael. That was the one thing that I actually meant to say that I forgot. So I'm going to claim that was my idea, and you just
it is totally
it.
Your idea, Brian. You just threw telemetry. Sent it
well,
to me.
And that's getting back into when we were talking about Dugan's before. I said we were going to circle back and talk about where that becomes useful with mm-hmm. ambience mics, which I think is the same general idea, whether you're doing it with a Ducker or a Dugan. So yeah, I mean, do you want to dive into that a teeny bit more?
I guess for me with the audience microphones, I don't do Dugan because I don't want to prioritize it over something else. I'll just have, two separate things. Either all my playbacks, that would be video roll or anything where I don't expect someone to talk, and goes to a bus, and that bus feeds a Dugan input that would duck all my stage microphones. So if someone's walking off a stage, that's cleaned up. And then vice versa, that same bus then goes to a ducker on the NAT microphone, so when the video starts, but it's a very slow ducker because I don't want like applause coming out. It's a slow attack, fairly quick release. So when there's like, you know, big dramatic video that's 90 seconds long, bass drop, I don't want that to be, I'll fade it out and make sure that ducker can rise naturally with applause out of a video, if that makes sense. But it helps me not have to think about, I just had an 8-lav panel into a video and my NATs. Like, all that is just simply bring out lavs, either on a lav DCA, which I hardly use. Usually just put my elbow on the desk and bring them down. I've prayed to Dan Dugan more than I have my Lord Jesus Christ.
Yeah, right. So, totally. The two hands scramble to get them all off, to get them all down.
Yeah. Anyway.
Prayed to Dan Dugan
I feel like we're getting more ideas for the merch store here. We'll get a little Saint Dugan.
Yes, we need Dan. Just Saint Dugan, Saint Dan. I love it.
I will say if you are going to use a Dugan on your ambient mics, that's where the waiting options in the Dugan become real important.
Yeah,
yeah, it's on default setting. Yeah, you're not going to use it at all. But like, there are ways you can do it to wait so that your presenter might. And again, less for an audience response mic is for like a room vibe, so that basically when people are talking, those are the lav inputs are weighted more to pull those down a little bit, but let the room fill in between. So it's almost a reverse 50-45 at that point.
Got it. So it's less of a, let's capture the emotion of a moment, but just kind of fill in room tone when
exactly.
You need it. Got it. Okay, that makes
it's
sense.
It's basically like if you're using the 50-45 or denoise to get out too much, then adding it back in. Like. Yep. I mean, I'll let people under the hood. In fact, I've been meaning to write this up for the Discord under the hood of the podcast, because we're all in such different rooms. I've actually taken lately to, I get rid of as much of the room as I can with Isotope and a couple other things. And then I cheat a little fake room tone back in so that there's still room tone and not dead air, but it puts us all into the same room.
Right, it's actually Times Square. It's not a room tone. He just went out Times Square with a Zoom recorder and got some tone. Some guy yelling about fucking pizza and cabs and shit, but you can't really tell.
What's hilarious is I couldn't find room tone that I wanted, so I used one of the Isotope, like the tone matcher options on a 20-minute silence to put in a what they actually have one they call podcast room tone, and ran that on the silence to make the silence sound like room tone, and that gave me a 20-minute loop of like a nice, quiet, gentle background room tone as sort of a comfort noise that bleeds in. And the other thing I've played with here on the podcast is a teeny tiny bit of a room reverb that we all go to help put us in the same room. And that's one thing I'd love feedback from listeners on, if you're digging that or not, or if it's too much. I know I had one person be like, yo, dude, your room sounds like you got to put some treatment in your room. And I'm like, no, my room actually sounds totally dead. That's the fake room I'm putting us all into, but I can dial it back. And as I've traded out the Dynamics plugins, it's changed how much of that I can use a bit. But yeah, I'm curious if it's working for folks or not. But that's also a thing we have to keep in mind with live streams. And yeah, so veering us back onto the road that, yeah, like using whether it's a Dugan or a Ducker on like your ambient room mics is basically helping a little bit with the I'm pulling enough of that out, or if I'm using cardioids and not getting enough room. And I don't want that echo when people are talking, but I want a little bit of the room to make it sound live afterwards. That's one way to accomplish that.
I've shied away from like a typical ballroom, screens left and right. I used to do a left and right, but I used to feel like there was a giant hole in the middle with them being. So I've done now more an X, Y off to one side of the room. Or if I get fancy pants, I can even do a mid side.
Yeah, like an EP88 or something.
Fancy pants.
Yeah. I don't get to do that too often, but if it's a simple show where I get to have fun and mess around, but it's just a simple run. It's one run, do the X, Y, and away you go. Because no one's going to be like, this microphone, this stereo image is off to one side of the room. It's like, as long as you're capturing the entire room.
Well, I also pull back in the panning. It doesn't, just because I have microphones left and right, that doesn't mean they have to be hard pan left and right. So I'll pull it back into... I guess in Yamaha world, each side is out of 63. So I'll pull it back into like 45 on each side. And that helps fill in that middle as well. And you get some of that kind of cross goodness going on there.
Yeah. And I mean, that's another big thing to... we'll edit that out after, Brian. Let me make a note.
It's amazing.
All right, let me ask you guys this, since we're like, 12 hours deep into this thing. What is the one tool for you that is indispensable on a corporate gig? What is the one thing that if somebody's like, hey, man, you got to fly in to do this, you absolutely cannot fucking live without and will not show up without this one tool on site?
I'm the one tool on site, usually.
No, bro, I'm always the tool on site. but you take my job. You're the smart one. I'm the tool. Don't ever forget.
While everybody thinks of that answer, I was going to say the one thing I was about to say that y'all just brought to mind is when we're doing the reinforcement in the room, we're never thinking about panning even for presenter mics. But when you're doing a stream, if you've got the option to do a stereo stream, panning your panelists out when you've got a multi-panelist helps so much. With over-talking, that's something podcast listeners will have discovered new in 2024 is Andy remembered that he could do a podcast in stereo and decided, I'm sorry, I'm going to take up twice your bandwidth on your phone, but as we get to these larger panel episodes, doing some stereo panning, it makes anytime anybody over-talks, you can actually understand what they're both saying. And I don't think enough of us doing streaming think of that.
I said I was sorry, Andy.
It's a valuable tool to add back in.
I said I was sorry.
Cool. Now I'll let y'all answer Sean's question.
I'm actually going to step in and go first. Then I have to go parrot my 5, 3, and 1-year-old at this point. But I very much appreciate the time. I would say it would be the ability to take my program out over Dante or whatever, sit on my computer and have that tonal balance control, especially when I'm in a room that I don't trust or a listening environment or, that one time that front of house is in a terrible position. You mean actually all the time, but
just the one.
Just the one. Just so I'm not having to do so much with headphones and double checking, whatever, that I can just do a quick glance and see. Again, I actually have forced myself to do several gigs without it because I just found myself looking over there too much. I just did like, I can trust my ears, Michael, darn it. Like I could do it. But especially for streaming, if it's supposed to sound like a studio thing, I can really trust that visual feedback.
Right on, and we'll let you go do the dad thing. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, dude. You rock.
Yeah,
and y'all rock.
Absolutely. Right.
And cool. Next, Brian, what you got?
I missed the question because my car took over my Bluetooth. So ask me the question one more time.
The question was, what is the one tool other than, you know, us ourselves? What's the one tool you got to have on a corporate gig to succeed? Will not show up without this one tool. Cannot do your show without this one tool.
I think it's going to have to be my TC Clarity Meter. I've really become addicted to it. Because yeah, like it's, well, that and my own, personal ClearCon headset.
Which headset?
I use a good old fashioned CC26 ClearCom lightweight headset. Nothing fancy.
Classic.
But I just, you know, I like keeping my germs to myself. And depending on the vendor, you know, sometimes they don't have lightweight headsets, or they have PH88s, which I absolutely hate, or whatever. So
hey, it was one time. I said I was sorry, dude. God. Yeah, we're all PH88s, and I've been eyeballing those ClearComs. Like, oh, those are pretty nice, dude. I'm gonna get some of those.
They're honestly the biggest thing with the ClearComs is that I've had this CC26 for at least a decade. I have absolutely abused it beyond anything, and I've been through, like, you know, five or six, you know, windscreens and ear things and everything else, and I can't kill it. I mean, for a lightweight headset, they're ludicrously robust. So.
Challenge accepted, bro. Challenge accepted. All right, Aaron, where are you at, buddy?
I mean, my first thought is just headphones, but I feel like that's more of a general, every audio person should be bringing those kinds of thing. So my cheating answer is going to be my laptop. The first, and it really has a lot less to do with mixing than you think, software-wise, Companion and a Stream Deck, let's say, but something where I can make some macros, make a lot of things happen on a desk in a very short amount of time that my hands would not be able to do, is something that's really invaluable to me, and especially controlling all kinds of different things at once. It's really,
we should do a whole episode on Companion at some point.
Can I change my answer?
Absolutely.
Because actually, Aaron's right. It's like, actually, if you absolutely help, you know, strap my hands down and said you can only have, got to have, and it has to be my computer, which is set up for my stuff the way I want it, doing the, you know. Yeah, I cannot imagine doing a corporate gig without my computer. Like, I could do without everything else. But yeah, I got to have my MacBook M2, and it's got to be set up. I literally just came off a gig where they had computers for everything for me, and I pulled theirs out and put mine in because I'm like, they're not set up for me. They're not the right way. I need my comfort Mac.
Yep. It's my emotional support laptop.
No, sorry, was that the one? That's right. I said with or without cheese. He said, I need my comfort Mac.
Oh, well, actually, okay, then the second thing I want is the Mac with the cheese.
Yeah, right, totally. Good catering. It's funny. All right, so for me, it's the same thing, computer. And mostly for me, that's because of Smart and then, you know, the playback, whatever I got, the, you know, the break music and the other, all the things we've curated over the years that you're like, no, this makes it easier, this does this, because... Like you said, that in-house vendor may not have all the stuff you need, but that was absolutely my answer too, was my computer, because it would come with my smart rig and my freaking playback and all that stuff too.
Yeah, it's like I can get into the hardware of like, well, the RUIO, but like without the computer, that's useless. And without the computer, like in a pinch, you know, I got to be careful about what I'm using because there's more latency, but I can do it with virtual sound card. I don't have that bypass option and stuff, but the computer is useful without the interface, not the other way around. I mean, the other one, particularly doing gigs with like PA du jour and, you know, hotel AV provider du jour, is a measurement mic.
Totally, dude.
That's, I will say, like 95% of this gig last week. And the reason, I won't say that I was there, but somebody like me was there, was enough of a give a shit to like ring stuff out and ring it out well to make sure the room sounded tight and clean and set us up both for a good in-room sound and a good stream.
For sure. For sure.
Oh, shizzle.
Well, thank you, fellas, for hanging out for damn near 2 hours. We're absolutely going to have to cut this up into two episodes or shoot me in the face trying to sit through 2 hours of us yapping about corporate stuff.
But no, I'm happy to add another one to the pool for save us from having to book a second episode.
I super duper appreciate you guys taking the time and hanging out and sharing your wisdom. Man, thank you guys so much for coming and rocking with us. And thanks to Alan Heath and RCF for supporting us and making it happen. We appreciate all you guys. And that's the pod. See you next week.
See ya, everybody.
See ya.
See ya.